Welcome to Parents' Perspective. A patient told me the following story. In 2003, she was at a Baltimore Symphony Orchestra concert. They were playing the Brahms Violin Concerto when suddenly the lights went out. In the utter blackness of the concert hall, her immediate thought was that Baltimore was under terrorist attack, a fear no doubt shared by many in that audience. She is uncertain how long they were in darkness before the dim emergency lights came on, probably only a few seconds, though it seemed longer. What amazed her was that the orchestra kept playing. Sitting in the dark, unable to see the conductor or their scores, the musicians played on flawlessly. No one in the crowd made a sound, though she remembers the ovation at the end of the piece was especially heartfelt. We are not often called upon to demonstrate courage by risking our lives, but in the numberless acts of quiet determination in the face of the anxiety that now infects this society, we perform a service to our country and to each other. Collectively, our attitudes and behavior create the atmosphere we live in, and more than any military action will ultimately determine the outcome of the struggle with terror in which we are now engaged. In the process, we might at last find something in ourselves of which we can be truly proud. This is an excerpt from And Never Stop Dancing by Dr. Gordon Livingston. From a parent's perspective, what kinds of life skills should we be imparting to our children as we aim to parent for life? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has a background filled with varied accomplishments and has written books that truly help with parenting for life. Dr. Gordon Livingston has a military background, having attended West Point Military Academy and having later volunteered for service in Vietnam, where he was a regimental surgeon and received the Bronze Star for Valor. He then trained in psychiatry. Dr. Livingston is also a parent twice bereaved. His first book, Only Spring, described the death from leukemia of his six-year-old son. He's the author of the bestseller, Too Soon Old, Too Late Smart, and other books including And Never Stop Dancing and his most recent, How to Love. He has also written for numerous periodicals. He's the father of four grown children and lives in Maryland, where he continues in the practice of psychiatry. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Livingston.
It's nice to be here.
What would you say is the biggest myth you've seen parents live with?
I think parents have an exaggerated idea of their own influence over their children. They tend to see their kids as being clay models that they mold into good citizens. My own feeling is that parents have less influence than that, and that by and large our children determine their own lives.
Boy, that's reassuring for a lot of parents, I think.
I find it reassuring, but it's interesting. At my daughter's college graduation, the final edition of the student newspaper had baby pictures of all the graduates and then a caption under them that the parents could write. And all the captions were the same. We're so proud of you. And that's an understandable sentiment at that time. But on the other hand, I thought there was a kind of self-satisfaction as if perhaps this accomplishment of their child had been their own. And I think it's not.
I think we all realize that at college graduations of children, we did not do it.
Exactly.
If parents are not the main influence on what their children are going to be, would you say there is a main influence?
Well, I think parents are an important influence, but it's their behavior that's important. It's not so much what they teach or what they tell their children or how many times they lecture them about morality. I think children learn most of what they know from their parents by observing their behavior.
We're the models, right?
Yes. I think parents have an important task in modeling behavior for kids.
It's funny. I think we all go through as parents the time just before we're ready to send a child off to college and we think, oh my goodness, I forgot to lecture about this. I forgot to tell them I better get that in before they leave because they may not know and all that. And there's that period of anxiety when we think somehow we're going to just shove it right in.
Yeah, and of course, in practicing psychiatry, I see the other side of that. I see parents of children who are not succeeding in some way, and what I get from them is a sense of self-blame that somehow if their children are using drugs or if they're hanging out with the wrong people or getting in trouble with the law, that that's somehow their failure as well. So my own feeling is that we need to be a little bit more modest and allow our children to claim both the credit and the responsibility for what they do in their lives.
If you had to give parents one nugget to remember, just like we try to give one nugget into our children before they leave home, what would that be then?
Well, it would be to teach by example. I think that that's what we're responsible for doing. We're responsible for transmitting optimism to our children. We're responsible for teaching them that with all the tragedy and lack of control in the world, that we can still live happily, and we do that by example.
You've just mentioned optimism. In your books, you discuss the significance of our worldviews as adults. Optimism, pessimism, cynicism. If we're not genuinely optimistic people, how can we pass this kind of positivism on to our children?
Well, it's pretty hard. In my latest book, which is about forming relationships, I have a chapter entitled First Deserve and Then Desire. And I think that that's also true of parenting, that if we expect our children to confront the world in an optimistic and hopeful way, then we need to look at ourselves and what sort of an example we're setting for them. The answer is that if you're a pessimist, it's pretty hard to teach anyone else to be an optimist.
Well, what are the benefits for our kids?
Well, the benefits are that in life we tend to get not what we deserve, but what we expect. And if we expect the best, both of ourselves and other people, we're much more likely to get that. Things go more smoothly in life for people who are optimistic.
Although it's interesting, I find myself, I'm pretty much of an optimist, and I am always shocked when people don't behave in a positive way that I think they should behave. So that would seem to be the downside.
Yeah, it is the downside, but it's in some ways true of all kinds of feelings. For example, people who are depressed or pessimistic are seldom disappointed. So that in some ways, that's a relatively safe position to be happy. To be optimistic is to risk being disappointed at times. But I think there's plenty of evidence that we also are much more likely to have people reciprocate our own hopeful outlook so that it's worth taking the chance that from time to time, we'll be disappointed that not everybody has our view of the world.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on parenting for life.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Gordon Livingston about parenting for life. You've said that sometimes in life it's the detours that define us. That's a very interesting soundbite.
Yeah.
How does this concept apply to parenting teens and young adults?
Yes. Yeah. I had a chapter title that went, Not All Who Wander Are Lost. And I think that that's really what I'm talking about there, that there's no one way to either live life or to prepare to live life, and that if parents can be a little more tolerant of particularly their adolescent children as they embark on what may look to us like detours or even dead ends, that's a vote of confidence in them that they'll find their way. And as long as they're not doing anything dangerous, why not let them experiment a bit? I mean, one of my children was very interested in acting. So when she graduated from college, my graduation present was a one-way ticket to Los Angeles.
Oh, my.
As it turned out, her acting career didn't work out. But I felt that that was something that she wanted to do and that I needed to be helpful with. And she's turned in different directions now, but I think it was important not to oppose that or in some other way not support it.
It's an example of letting children develop who they are as they are. And sometimes it's hard to encourage what you may see as a difficult life path.
Yes. I mean, even the process of choosing college majors is a frequent source of stress between parents and children. What are you going to do with an English degree, for example? But I think it's important to allow kids to experiment and find their way and to show them that you have confidence that they'll ultimately find something that fits.
It's almost as though raising children, we have to look at time differently than we do for our own lives, our everyday lives and our careers and all that.
Yeah, and particularly with adolescents, as they seem to go off on a lot of detours and fleeting interests. And sometimes if the parent is very goal-directed, they can get impatient with that.
What do you say to parents who say, well, but, you know, they're getting older. They need to know about reality. They need to be grounded in reality.
Yeah. Well, I usually ask them, well, how did you learn about it? Because I think that that's the encouraging thing, is that given the basic kind of love and support that we all try to give our children, things are likely to turn out well. I mean, even kids that I see who are struggling as children or adolescents, I've been doing this long enough now that I run into their parents at the mall at some later time, and almost always the news is good. The kids are doing fine, and all the anxiety that was lavished on these kind of temporary setbacks that they were experiencing turned out to have been wasted.
Do you think it's because as parents we feel like we don't have real control and it's frightening out there?
Yeah, I think it is a control issue. And so when I talk to kids, that's the part that they resent the most, the sense that they're being controlled or they're being programmed or they're being kind of forced to act in ways or do things that they really don't want to do. And that's productive of a lot of conflict. It's completely unnecessary. And these issues are fought out around things like room cleanliness or food. And that really is just a waste of time.
You've written one chapter entitled, Nobody Likes to Be Told What to Do. For all of the anxious parents listening to us chat, how do we delete that component of our repertoire and still raise civilized kids?
Well, this has to do with power struggles. So much of what goes on between parents and children seems to be based on the idea that we raise children only by kind of socializing them or forcing them to behave in certain ways, as if they were left to themselves, that somehow they would turn out to be selfish people. And I think that that assumption is wrong. I think by and large, if children are allowed a little bit more freedom, that they tend to be generous if the people around them are generous and kind if the people around them are kind, and that we could do without a lot of these power struggles. So much of what goes on between parents and children, again, particularly in adolescence, is some combination of lectures or directions that children resent. And so that sets people up for these passive-aggressive interactions in which the children, being relatively of smaller psychological and physical size, exercise whatever power they have by not doing what they're being told to do. They can't be forced to learn in school, or they can't be forced to turn in their homework. I don't know how many times I hear that, well, we did that homework together, but she just didn't turn it in. And I said, well, that sounds a little passive aggressive. Do you suppose she's feeling powerless? And once you begin to examine these interactions, you find that there's a lot of directions and lectures and instructions being given that are really unnecessary.
We have several 2-year-old grandchildren in our family right now, and we're experiencing the no stage, and it's so interesting. The younger of the two says, Mommy, no, do that. He is telling his mother, or Mommy, go away. Mommy, not come in. And it's really very cute because he's trying out his own power. And his parents are kind of puzzled by all this. And I've said, look, he's trying to see if he has any power at all. He's just a little 2-year-old.
Yeah, and that can be very threatening to some parents who feel that their authority is being challenged or somehow that they have to try to force their will on a 2-year-old. And in many cases, that turns out to be a rehearsal for some adolescent behavior to come.
And speaking of adolescent behavior, then, if a good parenting tactic is to give our kids some room and let them be empowered, what do you tell the anxious parents, especially around times when there are parties and proms and there's times when kids can get out of control?
Well, kids need reasonable limits, and by and large, they'll conform to reasonable limits. But if a parent is so anxious about all the things that could go wrong with drugs and sex and automobile accidents, the anxiety then is very contagious, and children will pick up on that and become anxious as well. So I try to get people to relax about some of that stuff because the kinds of things, our worst fears are seldom realized. And so I try to tell parents, there was a baseball umpire once who was asked if he ever made mistakes. And he said, well, I may be wrong, but I'm never unsure. and parents, I think, can also kind of adopt that approach because kids want to believe that their parents know what they're doing. So if there's a lot of parental anxiety around these issues, then they're likely to pick up on that. So I try to get parents to act more confident than they may sometimes feel.
How do you advise parents about guidelines and rules for children?
Well, that they should be reasonable. I mean, there's certain things that you have to do. You have to have a reasonable curfew. You have to teach your child that it's not safe to run into the street. And so there are certain things that that definitely have to be taught. But there are other things that are much less important having to do with whether their clothes match or whether their room is spick and span. And so if everything has to be a power struggle, then I think that just detracts from the pleasure of parenting, which are many.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on parenting for life.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Gordon Livingston about parenting for life.
In terms of the teenage limits of alcohol and drugs and all that kind of stuff, where sometimes kids don't have the anxiety because they think that they're immortal and nothing can ever happen to them and, oh, I'm only going to have a beer and get in the car and all that kind of stuff. What would you advise parents?
Well, it's a case-by-case thing. And, children are different. Some of them are very tractable and goal-directed and will kind of manage their own teenage years in a safe way. Others seem to want to take more risks or they're influenced by their peers and therefore need more monitoring. So it's really hard to generalize about that. But I think that if mistakes are made, they're usually in the direction of too much parental control. There are other aspects of this that occur when kids are younger and parents get panicked about things like stranger abduction, and then they are fingerprinting children and putting GPSs on them and everything. And I think that, considering that in the whole country there are probably 200 stranger abductions a year, just producing unnecessary anxiety in kids. And so almost all of what I do with parents is directed at trying to keep the anxiety in the house low.
You've written very powerfully about grief and loss in your own parenting. What would you especially want parents to understand for themselves and for others?
Well, because I've suffered some losses in my own life and written about them, I get to see a lot of bereaved parents. And this is, of course, a special category of people, and fortunately that catastrophe happens rarely. But in working with them, I try to get them to understand that now that the worst has happened to them, in a sense, they just have to go through this extended process of loss. But there are usually other children in the family who they've got to help through this as well and to whom they still have responsibility. And for most bereaved parents, that's what saves us, is the realization that while we've had this unspeakable loss, we still have people who depend on us and we still have people whom we love and who need us, and therefore we can't stop being a parent. We've got to just go through our grief and with the knowledge that it will soften with time. It'll never go away. And so that's what I tell people, that in the early stages of this, you just got to function as well as you can and take care of your other children as well as you can.
You've written of a society infected with the disease of gratification. As parents, how can we inoculate our own children against that?
Oh, if only we could. Just
take this pill. It only costs.
Right? Yeah, that would be nice. But I think we have to grant that we live in kind of a superficial society in which our cultural icons tend to be shallow people who themselves aren't very good at committing themselves. And the things that make them interesting and appealing to us are rather superficial, and that our children are going to get kind of caught up in that celebrity culture. It's inevitable. It's on our movie screens and in our magazines. And to convey to children that there are deeper traits and values that are worth cultivating, like loyalty and commitment to work and commitment to each other, I think that's an important task for parents, but it's usually not done by lecturing. It's more done by demonstrating in your own life that those are the values that are important. And I think that in some ways that we are, as parents, we're kind of at war with the culture and the influences. I mean, my own sense is that the most important thing that we're going to teach our children has to do with how to form permanent, satisfying, committed relationships to at least one other person in their lives. And in doing that, we have to kind of manifest those traits that make us, especially kindness, you know, that make us good candidates for that kind of relationship. And we have to show that that's the most important thing in our lives as well. So, and I think we could get more help with this. I mean, I think there ought to be courses in high school on the pursuit of happiness, and in which kids are exposed to different personality types so that they can begin to discern the people who are likely to break their hearts on the one hand, or who are self-absorbed and uninterested in close relationships, and the people on the other hand who manifest kindness and courage and commitment and are the kinds of people that we want to draw close to. So I think that there's definitely an educational problem there, and I think we ought to be about the business of developing curricula that will help teach those values.
I think there was a study not too long ago that was talking about when kids were interviewed of the people who were most significant in their lives, and it wasn't the movie stars, and it wasn't the sports stars, and it wasn't the cultural heroes. It was the coach, the teacher, the parent, the grandparent, et cetera.
Yes, I mean, that's hopeful, isn't it? Because our children seem kind of fascinated in some way by the culture of the television and the movie screen, but they're smart, and by and large, they, I think, at least by late adolescence, come to understand that these other influences, you know, these people that expose them to values that are really important, and we hope that their parents will be among them, you know, are the people that are really going to make a difference in their lives.
Well, it seems like we gravitate toward people who show us that we're important to them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And if there was one skill that I wish parents would teach their children, both by example and by emphasizing its importance, it's listening. You know, I mean, this is such an important skill, to be able to listen to another person with real attention. And that's what makes the difference in relationships later on, as opposed to the people who spend their time being glib and superficially attractive and with a gift for gab. But it's the ability to listen to someone else, I think, that really draws them to you.
In addition to your own books, what resources would you recommend to our listeners who want to further pursue their interest in this area, Dr. Livingston?
Well, you know, one book that is a good reference is Hein Gannott's, G-I-N-O-T-T, classic work, Between Parents and Child. But there now is a school of positive psychology that I think people ought to pay some attention to, that's been developed at the University of Pennsylvania. And Martin Seligman is one of the creators of that school, and has written a book called The Optimistic Child, and is now working a lot around the whole issue of positive education and teaching of optimism. So those are two good references.
Well, this was positively a very educational time with you, Dr. Gordon Livingston, and we're so pleased that you could be with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sandy. It was a pleasure being here.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of one of Dr. Livingston's books, Too Soon Old, Too Late Smart, and Never Stop Dancing, and How to Love. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 408 and tell us, if you can, what station you're tuning into.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. At the end of our program, we often thank individuals or foundations for their generous donations that help with the cost of producing Parents' Perspective programs. Parents' Perspective Incorporated is a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. Today it is our turn to thank you, our listeners, for your tax-deductible contributions to our annual fundraising campaign. Please send your checks or money orders to Parents Perspective Incorporated, Post Office Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015. And thank you for helping us continue to work for you. Our sound engineer is Elizabeth Buckle. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.